This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE-FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast. Simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone or tablet and search for DC 37 State of the Union. There are also now more ways to stay in touch with the union. You can check out our website, www.dc37.net. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you have any comments about our show, or if you would like us to promote a community event, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Joining us this evening by phone from Washington, D.C. is the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Director of Research and Negotiations, Steve Kreisberg. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Thank you, Chris. Always a pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
Well, you know, things have been going on. It's been, I hope you have had a good summer. And I saw that recently the Gallup folks came out with a poll survey, and they've been doing this regularly over the years, and they declared that American unions are more popular than they've been in 50 years, which is the result of good work by people like you. What does it mean, this Gallup survey?
Well, you know, they do it every year, and it's nice to be popular.
Yes, it is.
You know, I would like to point out that our approval rating is probably double that of the president's.
And most Congress people, I would imagine.
I would say so. Yeah. And so the you know, it's really an interesting, it's an interesting result, and we're on the upswing. I think the American public recognizes the value of the labor movement, and of course the irony at the same time that we're gaining popularity, we're really not gaining traction with many of the policy proposals that we need to, you know, maintain or create a robust labor movement in the United States. And we still have an economy that's not working for workers.
Now,
so, you know, we have this kind of mismatch, right? And I think the public recognizes that. And I think they realize that there is no better advocate for workers than unions, that we can't count on the political system. We even can't count on very good allies in politics to do this for us, that we have to do this for ourselves. And that's what unions are all about, is workers joining together and doing it for themselves.
There was also something that I found particularly interesting. The folks who like unions the most seem to be young people. And that says something, I think, about the aspirations and the values of the what the union movement is about.
Yeah, and it does, and it gives me hope. It really does. I think you see among some younger workers kind of a greater social consciousness than we see among some of the folks who, like me, have been around for a while, right? I mean, people of my generation, as a baby boomer, have not embraced the unions the way the younger folks have. There's probably a lot of reasons for that. First of all, I think they have suffered the most from lack of opportunity in this economy. And so they see unions as a way out. I think they also like this notion of being connected. I think, you know, maybe their version of being connected differs than traditional versions because technology has changed and our culture has changed. But I do think that they have a value on being connected. And unions are a way that people connect with one another to achieve a common goal.
We were talking last week with Mario Salento, who's the head of the New York State AFL-CIO, and he was talking about the priorities of, in New York State, of the AFL-CIO being the gig economy, but trying to engage folks from the gig economy into a collective action mode. And that's a big rock to climb, or big rock to lift, because of, as you say, people work differently than they used to.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's, you know, there's this whole idea of are some of the folks who work within these online platforms, are they really employees of the platforms? In other words, am I working for Uber or
right.
Lyft or am I working on my own and for myself, but this is kind of helping me, kind of brokering, if you will, the next job. So that's kind of a separate question. In California, there was a very exciting and positive decision out of its courts that essentially found that these types of workers are really workers for the online platform because the online platform controls so much of what they do. They have, they really have the element of control of that employment relationship. But without getting into those
legal details, what's the significance of that? What does that mean?
Well, if I'm an independent contractor, I essentially can't join a union, right? Because I'm not working. I don't have an employer. I'm working for myself.
Right.
Now, I can join a union, but I mean, I can't have collective bargaining.
Right, right.
So we have to then create a relationship among the independent contractors. And that could be an antitrust violation, right? We don't let Coke and Pepsi have a relationship for marketing because they're independent entities. And that's the same way independent contractors are thought of as independent entities, and it would be price fixing if you and I agreed, well, we're not going to drive for less than $1.50 a mile.
Oh, okay.
So it could be, you know, but if we're workers, we're exempt from those kind of antitrust provisions. So it gets kind of complicated legalisms, and I'm oversimplifying a bit just for the sake of our discussion. But the fact of the matter is, if you're an independent contractor, you don't have an employer to bargain with anyway. So that's really the killer right there.
And one of the great challenges, you're saying, is
I think that's what Mario is getting at.
Right.
Now, with that said, and I do think we ought to bring the ability to organize to these independent contractors, especially those in the online platforms. But there's a couple of caveats that I would put out there that may distinguish, you know, my views from some others, including perhaps Mario's. I think the amount of people that are employed in the gig economy is often overstated. It's really no more now than it was 10 or 12 years ago as a percentage of the workforce.
That's interesting.
And I think the reason why we're getting much more attention about it is because a lot of the people who are working in the platforms are not doing so voluntarily. You know, they're doing it kind of as a side gig because they can't get the kind of regular employment that will pay them a decent wage. So I think that in some cases, yeah, people like it. They like that flexibility and they pick up the money. But for a lot of folks who are in this, and, you know, no two people are exactly alike, of course. But for a lot of folks, if they had a good, well-paying 40-hour job,
right,
you know, where they can take care of their needs, they're not so interested in driving around picking up people, for endless hours. They might want to do it, you know, for a few hours because it's interesting and fun. But after a while, that's difficult. And the wear and tear on yourself and especially on your vehicles makes the effective wage of that kind of work very low.
And let me just ask this, because this is one of those things that when we talk about employment and we see that employment numbers are up, there is also the factor of underemployment or the fact that folks are working two jobs. I have a relative who works 34 hours a week and he is busting his hump to, you know, work in a position that doesn't pay benefits because they're not giving him the full 35 to 40 hours a week that would get him benefits. I sense that there's been more of that in the last decade than less. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is correct. So if you're 35 hours a week or more, you're considered full time, and they have to offer you health benefits, and the employers don't want to do that, so they're keeping you at 34. They're keeping wages down, although we have what's considered to be, you know, as the president would say, record low unemployment. It's not exactly that the case, but we do have very low unemployment by any measure. We're not seeing the rise in wages that we ought to see. Something's gone wrong with our economy. In a time when we have full employment, sustained full employment, and including and continuing job growth, even though it's not at the same pace as we were growing jobs under Obama, we're still growing jobs under Trump, we should be seeing rising wages, and it just hasn't happened.
And the reason for that?
Some economists have pointed out that somewhere between 20 and 33%, in other words, between a fifth and a third of the reason, is because of the decline of unions.
Right.
We're simply not able as workers to get our fair share. I mean, corporate profits are at record levels, and they were at record levels before we did this ridiculous tax cut a couple of years ago for corporations. And so the idea that we needed to do that tax cut to stimulate corporate investment because they just weren't making profits was crazy. It was irrational. There was no factual justification for it, but yet we've done it. So corporations continue to make record profits. They've engaged in stock buybacks. So rather than invest and expand production, expand jobs, because they just don't see the value in that. If they thought they could make money doing that, they would. They're bidding up their stock price and making the stockholders a little bit wealthier. So they've just given the money back to the shareholders, and by doing stock buybacks, of course, you're not enriching your workers. You're not giving workers pay raises, and that's been documented. So workers have been left out of the gains from that tax cut to a remarkable extent. Workers have gotten, there were some tax cuts that obviously workers received, but in places like New York that have an income tax, there's also been the loss of those tax deductions. So for workers, the so-called tax cut turned out to be relatively minor. For corporations, it's a big deal.
And I just read somewhere that the tax cut, whatever the middle class, average middle class person got from the tax cut, has been pretty much wiped out by the tariffs. I mean, I don't know if that's, that makes sense to me. If the Chinese are raising prices and Americans who are consuming a lot of Chinese goods, it would make sense to me that there is a price you have to pay for that, right?
Of course. And then what we've done is we've now taken the gains from the tariffs, if you will, right, the revenue that the federal government has achieved from the tariffs, and we've had to give it back to the farmers in Iowa and elsewhere,
right?
Because the poor farmers can't sell anymore, right? And the real concern is, I mean, if you really want to get global about this, so in Brazil, they're going to try to replace us in growing soybeans and export to China. So now we are unintentionally creating more international competition for our domestic goods, for the farmers. So Trump is doing lasting damage to our agricultural industry, which is probably not of great concern to your New York City listeners, but it should be of concern to the nation as a whole. I mean, this is a short-sighted approach, and I think what it demonstrates for Trump is like he wants to fight for workers. And I'll tell you what, he deserves credit for that, because for too long we've had politicians of both parties who didn't want to fight for American jobs. And the fact of the matter is, he may be fighting, but he's fighting the wrong battles. And at the end of the day, it's not about good intentions. At the end of the day, it's about being smart and able to produce for the American people. And on that, he's completely failed. So even if we give him high marks for intentions, and I'm not saying I necessarily do, but even if we would give him those high marks, his strategy is fundamentally flawed.
Brother, I covered that man for the New York Post for years, and that man is a real estate gonif. So you can talk about good intentions if you want, but I don't think he has any intentions, except he's got 30% of the voters, and he's talking to those people, and he's talking to them relentlessly, and I do not understand how long this is going to take before the...
Well, I think we have to understand his political brand, right? His political brand is he wants to be the guy that's fighting.
Right.
And he signaled that even before he was inaugurated, when he said, I'm going to keep those carrier jobs at the Indiana plant.
Right? And they didn't.
And they didn't keep them. But compare and contrast that, unfortunately, with President Obama, who invited the CEO of Honeywell into the White House dozens of times while that CEO was locking out his same workers in Indiana, ironically or coincidentally.
Right.
So, you know what I mean? So people perceive this guy is on their side. You and I both know he's not. You can just look at his policies and you know he's not on our side.
Well,
look at his results, we know he's not on our side.
It's about
his brand, and that's what he understands.
Yeah, but talk to me about what the... Actually, talk to me after we take a break, because we've got a whole second segment. We're talking with Steve Kreisberg. He is the Director of Research and Negotiations for the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, and we'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. Our guest is Steve Kreisberg. He is the Director of Research and Negotiations for AFSCME, the National Union of DC 37. We were talking about Trump at the break, and I would like to shift the gear just a little bit in terms of the actual record. What has happened to the American worker in terms of worker safety in the workplace, in terms of overtime, in terms of wages, in terms of as a result of policies of the Trump administration?
Yeah, I think, Chris, it's safe to say that this is the most anti-worker administration we've seen, even worse than either of the Bushes or Ronald Reagan. This has been just extreme in terms of what we've done. First of all, we talked about the tax cuts and wage stagnation. I mean, you have to start there. So financially, most workers are not doing better. Considering how well the economy has done, I mean, Obama had set the stage for a robust economy. We should be seeing wage growth, and we're not. So we can start there. We can then move on to how the president is handling health care, where he's eroding health care coverage.
Which is a huge cost,
right? I mean, at this point, it far outstrips the costs of retirement benefits, and it has for some years now. So we're seeing that erosion of health care, which is a big deal, and health care that we're talking about for most folks that they get in the workplace through their collective bargaining agreements or through their employer's policies. So financially, the administration has not been beneficial for workers. And then, of course, the trade policies are costing us jobs. We've seen negative GDP over the last 12 months in manufacturing. So all this talk about a return of manufacturing has not. It just hasn't happened.
Right.
Right? We've lost. We've lost manufacturing in the last 12 months, even in a growing economy. He was going to return jobs to the mining industry, despite the fact that it's ruining our environment. He's repealed many of the environmental regulations that we need to continue to have a planet that we can inhabit. But yet, as we're seeing in Kentucky as we speak, coal jobs are still going away at a record pace, right? And these guys in Kentucky didn't even get their paychecks. They're all Trump supporters. These were the guys who supported him. He was going to bring back coal.
Right, right.
As we remember, right?
Right. You're getting back to the but this is back on the political brand, the promise versus the reality.
Right. It's like I'm going to fight for those coal jobs. But right. The reality is coal's never coming back. Secretary Clinton had, you could say, the honesty of saying that. She says, look, we're not bringing those coal jobs back, but we need to figure out a way to create economic development in your community. But they didn't want to hear it. I mean, the folks in West Virginia and Kentucky didn't want to hear it. They want their coal jobs.
Right.
Why, I can't really understand. It's not a particularly good job. It doesn't pay well anymore. But it was the jobs that they knew, and I guess it's part of their culture. But in any event, Trump said he was going to fight for those jobs. He's failed in that fight. But he keeps on saying coal is back. It's not back, and it's never coming back. So that's, again, so we've lost jobs. We've lost income. If we look at this in a broader sense and getting away from, you know, manufacturing and mining and just talk about the economy more generally, he's eroded health and safety regulations. They have actually issued a regulation that would allow minors under the age of 18 to operate what had always been considered relatively dangerous equipment in healthcare facilities, lift machinery. Why?
Yeah, well, what?
That's
one of the most absurd pieces of legislation I've ever heard.
Well, so we can replace, a 25-year-old who's earning, $14 an hour with a 17-year-old who they're going to wound up paying, $9.50 an hour? Is that how we're going to build prosperity in America? I don't think so.
Right.
At least that's not my vision. I don't think it's your vision. And it's certainly never been AFSCME's vision of how we create a prosperous economy. So when we look at that kind of mindset, it's alarming. In the last years of the Obama administration, we proposed raising the threshold at which anybody would be automatically eligible to overtime to under $47,000 a year. Meaning, if you made less than that amount, you had to be paid time and a half. this is a big deal for people who work in retail.
Right.
Some of these chains, right. And you know what, you know, these kind of cheap store chains, you know, dollar stores and Five Below and all the rest of them, they hire people and they call them assistant managers. And they say, you're exempt from overtime and I'm going to work you 60 hours a week and pay you $12 an hour. And then they don't get overtime. So that was going to be addressed by Obama, saying if you're not going to pay these people at least $47,000, you're going to have to pay them time and a half after 40 hours.
And Trump went and undid that.
They undid that, and now they've issued a regulation that would reduce that threshold from 47 as Obama had planned, and the Department of Labor under Obama had issued a regulation on that. They've reduced it to $35,000. That threshold in a proposal that they'll probably finalize within the next 60 to 90 days. So there's another example of eroding the labor standards under which Americans work. They've opposed an increase in the minimum wage. The federal minimum wage, as we speak, is still $7.25 an hour.
Unbelievable.
Trump and the Republican Congress refuse to address it. The Democrats in Congress, under the leadership of Nancy Pelosi, have recently passed the Raise the Wage Act, which would get us to $15 an hour over the next few years. New York has done something similar at a statewide level. But this is what's necessary to move the economy forward. We have too many people in low-paid jobs. The labor market is not working effectively for us. So we need to have government intervention to make sure that people who work can actually take care of themselves.
And the policy – and we have to – listen, we can't say this enough. The policies that are proposed and enacted – matter. I mean, they really do hit the button. It's not some weird thing that's happening in an abstract way in Washington, D.C. These are rules and regulations that are absolutely hitting working people in the pocketbook.
Absolutely matters. And I think people think of, you know, Washington, D.C. as some abstract place.
Right.
But it's not. It's real. And what happens here is real. We've seen him put people on the National Labor Relations Board who are reversing decades of progress, decades of precedent to make it harder for unions to organize. We started the show talking about the popularity of unions, and we have an administration who's making it harder and harder for workers to join together in a union. It's clearly anti-worker. I mean, workers should have that right. And they're undermining the right. If workers choose not to have a union, that's a choice that workers get to make. But they're tilting the playing field in such a manner that workers don't even have a meaningful choice. They can't organize unions. They do so at the risk of their livelihoods. And Trump is making it easier for employers to engage in that kind of behavior.
We're talking with Steve Kreisberg. He is the Director of Research and Negotiations for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, which is D.C. 37's national union. Now, taking it from Washington a bit, there was under, in the past few years, there have been state-by-state attacks on workers so that state legislatures and state governors, and we should talk about who these people are, have in fact been taking away the rights of public employees to collectively bargain, the rights of private sector workers to organize. What is happening? Take us back a little bit about what has happened and what is happening now. Has there been any change?
Well, in the early part of this decade, there was it seemed to be a pitch battle in a dozen states to maintain the right to organize and to fight off right to work legislation. And we suffered significant defeats. Everybody, of course, is familiar with what Scott Walker did to public employees in Wisconsin, as well as enacting right-to-work legislation in the private sector. Rick Snyder in Michigan did the same. We still have collective bargaining rights for public employees, but they restricted the ability of union members to just have their, you know, pay their dues through the convenience of dues deduction if you work for a school district. So all of these kinds of little anti-union behaviors. Iowa, a few years ago, did the same. They stripped out meaningful collective bargaining from public workers. So we've suffered these kinds of setbacks. We had to go to the voters in Ohio to reverse some of the most egregious anti-worker legislation passed by any state. And the voters supported us with 61% of the vote versus 39% supporting the governor. That was Governor Kasich at the time. That's what we were living with at the beginning of this decade. Now, fast forward a little bit to the end of the decade, over the last couple of years, we had a huge setback, as you know, with the Janus decision, known as the JAS decision, which made the entire public sector right to work. And you and I have talked about this before on your show.
Yep.
But that was done by the U.S. Supreme Court. But at the state level, we've seen governors and legislatures like those in New York, Governor Cuomo and the legislature in New York, seek to help unions by leveling the playing field in light of the JAS decision. So we've had positive legislation in places like New York, New Jersey, and other states. So where we've been able to have worker-friendly politicians, and they tend to be Democrats, almost right now exclusively Democrats, we've been making good progress. Washington, Oregon, California are three great examples of some of the places where we've done really well. We've raised minimum wages. We've created better working conditions. We've gotten labor standards, better overtime protections. So elections matter, and we really are now on the march, and I think making a lot of progress at the state level. And if we look around at the 10 or so remaining presidential candidates on the Democratic side, almost all of them are pro-labor.
Right.
The ones that were not supportive of labor as much as the others are kind of gone. Like, you know, John Hickenlooper, gone. Michael Bennett, I don't know if he's gone or not, but he's irrelevant.
He might as well be gone.
He might as well be gone, and he should be gone. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, but I think what we're seeing now, if you look at the leading contenders, you know, whether it be Vice President Biden, Senator Warren, Senator Sanders, Mayor Buttigieg, they're all pro-labor, right? These are pro-labor people. You know, obviously, I don't mean to neglect Senator Harris from California.
Right. Your point is made. These folks, and they've had to go in front of no less than AFSCME to make their case for how much they support labor. There was recently a forum in Vegas, I think you
That's
guys
right.
had.
Beginning of August, we had a forum where basically 20 of them at the time trotted through, and they all professed their support for labor organizing in the public service. They basically said, you know, only about half of the states authorize public employees to bargain. I mean, there's some states that say, no, it's unlawful for public employees to bargain and don't recognize the right. All of them said they would support federal legislation that recognizes the right for public employees to engage in collective bargaining. So that was a very good thing. And they talked in more specific terms about policies, and it was remarkable. It was absolutely remarkable, and you can see the video of this, you know, through our website or the Huffington Post website, where because we co-sponsors, if you want to watch this forum. But it's remarkable to hear those statements and compare and contrast the kinds of things that Democratic presidential candidates are now publicly saying versus what those same party was saying in 2004, for instance.
We've got about a minute left. And I completely blacked out on the question that I wanted to ask you to answer in that last minute. But so when we go back to the poll, when we see the policies, when we see what's up in the future, you nailed it on the head. Elections matter, sir. Yes, elections matter.
Elections matter. And we have a big one next year. People have heard about it, right?
Right.
They're going
That's
to be
right.
interested. There's enthusiasm.
All right. Well, Steve, I got to cut this short. Thank you, as always. You did the whole show, man. It was the whole show this week, and I really appreciate you coming on. Steve Kreisberg is the Director of Research and Negotiations for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Thank you.
You're welcome, Chris. Always a pleasure.
All right. So that's just about all the time we have on this show. I've got one announcement to make. On September 19th at 6 p.m., 125 Barclay Street, housing experts from DC 37's Municipal Employee Legal Services will be on hand to tell you about the new tenant protections that exist. Come learn your rights as tenants. Andrea Minocchio is the engineer. Rudy Orozco is the producer. I'm Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.